My name is Thomas Riley, Dutchess County Public Defender. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Leandre Jennings, who was tried by jury and found guilty of murder in the first degree, for firearm committed felony, and possession of a firearm by a prohibited person, who sentenced to life plus. The issues that I raised are the validity of the obtaining of the CSLI information on the defendant's cell phone, and then the validity of the search of the residence. By way of a factual background, I'll just briefly summarize. The case arose out of what I guess would be called a home invasion. Two masked men entered a house, armed. They're confronted by the resident, the deceased, Mr. Brinkman, shot, killed. And obviously a significant investigation followed. The issue concerning the CSLI is important because the state relied on that to place the defendant, or at least his cell phone, in the area of the homicide.
Is there anything in this case that distinguishes the CSLI issue that we have before us from the State versus Brown decision that we've previously made?
You know, there's an old saying, first you don't succeed, try again. Try to convince the court that maybe we've gone a little bit too far on the searches. There is a distinction in this case, though, in that procedurally, the way this thing worked is you can see that originally they obtained, the police obtained the information from the cell provider by way of a order, although if you look at it, it's in the record. It's pretty confusing because they call it a search warrant, like you've told them before, this ain't a search warrant, but they continue to use this boilerplate paper that they submit to the court that says the search warrant on it. The initial part says we find probable cause to believe that the information, that there's sufficient probable cause to believe that the information is relevant. And then you go into the body of it and it talks about the Stored Communications Act and reasonable suspicion, or reasonable likelihood that they're going to find information on it. So it's a mess. And procedurally what happens is our case moves along. After the arrest, we have pretrial motions. And what occurs is Carpenter gets on the Supreme Court docket. And we kind of all agree that, you know what, this case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court is right on the nose as to whether or not there's a reasonable expectation of privacy requiring probable cause. Maybe I'm taking a little bit of poetic license here, but after the oral argument in Carpenter, I think the state got a little bit nervous about what was going to happen, which eventually did happen. So they went and got a search warrant for the same information they had already obtained through this, what we know to be now unlawful violation of the Fourth Amendment, obtaining of the CSLI. So there is a distinction between Brown and this case. More significantly and interestingly, when you reviewed the court's order in this case, there is no mention of Crawley. There is no mention of the only mention of the original court order is the court's determination that it was an unlawful court order and was unlawfully obtained. The court's whole order on this was on the validity of the search warrant. The court kind of moved to the side the Krull issue or any good faith reliance. That's not mentioned in the court order whatsoever. So question becomes, at least that my initial approach to this was, all right, If that's the way the court addressed it, that's how I have to raise it on appeal and try to convince this court that the court's order was incorrect. And there are basically two bases for that. One is that this is the fruit of the unlawful seizure of the CSLI information by way of the invalid court order.
So is there no way that the state can ever go back and correct?
Well, you know, I guess that's the question at this point that this court is going to have to determine whether or not if you already have the information in your possession and you know that it's likely going to be determined that it was unlawfully in your possession or seized improperly, can we then go and get a search warrant for the same stuff we already took unlawfully and save the day? And my suggestion is that that's going a little bit, I suggest, too far. The, you know, I've addressed with this court on several occasions the issue of overbreadth and particularity when it comes to these kinds of searches. And I once again urge the court to examine what we're doing here. While I would concede that at the time that they originally got the court order, or obviously, and by the time they started the search warrant, they had probable cause to arrest the defendant. As you may recall, they had some DNA, and then they did a CODIS search, and they were the CODIS hit that it's possibly Leandre Jennings. And they had some issues with the identifying the vehicle that was at the scene, et cetera. So I grant that there was probable cause to arrest him. The question then becomes, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said since the 70s, okay, just because there's probable cause to arrest someone doesn't mean that there is also probable cause to search any given item. There has to be some nexus between the item to be searched or the residence to be searched and the crime itself. I know this court has addressed on several things in Henderson and Goins issues about whether or not the search of a cell phone under the factual situation that was presented in those cases was sufficient. In this case, there's absolutely no evidence contained either in the record or in the affidavit that would indicate that the cell phone usage there was some conspiracy beforehand. There's some evidence that two people had conversations planning this out or planning their escape or escaping from the scene. What we're really dealing with here is what appears to be the Omaha Police Department's belief that if there's probable cause to arrest someone, there is automatically probable cause to seize and search their cell phone. And they present that to the court, and the courts have, by and large, the magistrate court have by and large approved the searches, even though there is nothing in the affidavit to suggest that anything involving the crime is connected to the cell phone. What the affidavits are basically saying is, and I'm just going to boil it down to plain old English, hey, there's good stuff on these phones, and it can really be helpful. You know, we might be able to tell where this guy was when this happened. Okay, so we have to decide what the court's going to have to decide, I guess, if not in this case, some other case, is in the absence of some affirmative evidence to indicate that there is a nexus between the content of the cell phone or the cell phone, the CSLI information, and the crime, whether or not the Fourth Amendment says you need more, or this is just a general.
Why would it not be sufficient to say to the court, we have this DNA evidence that this gentleman probably committed this crime. We know that he had a cell phone with him, and maybe that's an assumption that's not in this record, and that cell phones can tell you where somebody was. So we want to see what's on the cell phone.
I think, Mr. Chief Justice, I think you hit the nail on the head. And that was, we know that he had possession of the cell phone. No, we don't. See, therein lies the crunch. And as you said, well, or we're assuming, just because the cell phone is somewhere doesn't mean that the suspect or even the person who has a cell phone or is registered owner of the cell phone is in possession of it at the time.
What particularity would or would not be sufficient to link the possession of the cell phone with those independently found facts other than modern people tend to carry phones or something?
Therein lies that's exactly the crutch. Modern people, the U.S. Supreme Court has talked about in Riley and Carpenter, you know, we're going to have to start reexamining how we're dealing with the Fourth Amendment as it deals with these electronic devices because they're a treasure trove of information.
But that's a so what, because I'm just focusing on, say, on locations. Possession of the phone, and let's say it's on, and your location will have been found regardless of the content.
I see your point.
Somebody went to the scene of the crime and didn't live there, so they must have gone someplace else.
Well, therein lies the point, is are we at the point in history now where we're willing to say, if you are a suspect in a crime, and we can prove that you have a cell phone, or are a registered owner of a cell phone, that the Fourth Amendment allows there to be a search? Because
Or a search limited to location.
Well, the
data, not that other stuff.
It becomes a circular argument, because now we're back to the point of, okay, what's the probable cause to search the cell phone for the cell site location? I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has said there is a reasonable expectation of privacy in this, and that in order to overcome that reasonable expectation of privacy, there has to be some evidence in the way of proving probable cause to believe that this is going to present evidence of the crime. Well, what we're saying is, what the state typically saying is, well, of course it's going to prove evidence of the crime, because we want to know where he was at the time, or at least where his cell phone was at the time. Well, that translates into every person that could, there's probable cause to arrest, and we automatically can get the cell site location of your phone. We don't need any evidence to prove that you were in possession of it, that there was any previous usage of the phone. What you're saying is, okay, you're a suspect, there's probable cause to arrest you, give me your cell phone because I want to see where you were when this happened.
Mr. Riley, yes. You were on sort of a roll, and I hated to interrupt, but I want to ask you the question. If the search warrant application says something like, we've got this evidence of identification that suggests that there's probable cause that this person committed the crime, that we know, because at the time he was arrested or obtained, he had a cell phone. We also know, because we went to the cell phone companies, that he was the registered person before the date of the crime, and they put all of that in the warrant, so that if you've got it bracketed, isn't there an inference that flows from something like that, that at the time of the crime, he had the device?
Well, see, that's an assumption that's not backed up by the evidence. What we know is that after we get the evidence, after we get the CSLI, we know that the phone was in the area at the time. Police don't know that before they get the CSLI. They're saying he's a suspect.
So before and after, even to take my hypothetical to an extreme, an hour before the crime, he goes to the
you name the cell phone provider store, and obtains a cell phone. An hour after the crime, he's arrested with it on his person. That's not strong enough with those facts in a search warrant to raise the inference that a reasonable magistrate could rely on to say he had it with him at the time of the event.
That may be true, but there's no evidence that the defendant was arrested with the phone on him. As a matter of fact, the phone...
Well, I was talking in the hypothetical.
Sure, I see
and
that.
I grant you, you need to make and are making the case that this is outside the hypothetical. But I want to see, because it strikes me that the argument you're making, taken to its extreme, would say the hypothetical that I propounded, you still couldn't get a search warrant because you didn't know at the exact moment that he had the cell phone.
I think under your hypothetical where he gets it an hour, he gets the
then
phone, of course, an hour before.
Then, of course, we're just talking about staleness after that, right?
I'm sorry?
After, if you concede my hypothetical.
I do.
Then we're talking about what are the boundaries? When does it become stale, the information?
Well, that's right. I mean, the difference is in this case, the phone, the actual physical phone that would have been registered to him at the time was not the phone, it's the same phone number, but not the same phone that he was arrested with, okay? So
his girlfriend's phone?
No, no.
So you change Justice Castle's hypothetical and he gets a burner phone, right?
Well,
easy come, easy go.
You know, I'm technologically challenged a little bit.
Okay.
That's right.
Right.
I mean, my
right.
thing
not,
is
not a
phone.
Monthly bill like a middle class person who watches
the
their
phones,
monthly bill and gets all kinds of plans.
Yeah, the beauty of the burner phone is
they don't know
who the owner is. You could put
right.
Joe Slobotnik and it wouldn't make any difference, you know.
Before your time runs out, I'd like to talk about a different matter. You challenged the photographs of a couple items of clothing during trial. Could you address that?
Yeah, basically, they searched the residence, and they seized some items. And some of them they just put in to evidence through the photograph instead of bringing the physical jacket into evidence.
Were those pictures of those items actually seized, or were they just photographed before the search?
Well, they took the items, and they seized them. They're hanging in the closet. They wanted to show, well, the way they do these things now, the police take 8,000 photographs of every scene, okay? Good for them. The more the merrier on that. So what they want to do is they want to show where the item was found before they seize it. So, you know, the only thing I can guess is these days with no one wanting to touch items, they say, well, okay, here's the photograph. It's what the jacket looks like. And we're putting it into evidence. So they seized it.
All right, and what's your argument that shouldn't have came at trial then?
All I'm saying is that the search was unlawful. I'm not complaining about whether it was a photograph or the actual jacket. What I'm saying is that the photograph was...
I can see that point, but what was illegal about that search to those particular items?
Two things. One is that it included evidence that was obtained as a result of previous unlawful search because of the affidavit through that. And secondly, once again, I go to the same place I've been, that these warrants are overbroad. I mean, in Henderson, I know it was a cell phone case, and we're talking about the search of the house, but the court said, you know what, this any and all thing that you guys are using in the language, any and all, isn't going to fly anymore. So they took note of that, and instead of using the term any and all, what they do is itemize any and all, any possible thing that could be there. Look at, on, for instance, on the search warrant and the affidavit support. Every electronic device known to man is listed in there, even though there's absolutely no evidence to say that there was a computer used in this thing, or disks, or you name it. Let's look at the search warrant and put every possible thing that a human being can own, and put it in there. I mean, you know, I know the severance doctrine gives them some leeway. They put any and all clothing or any and all items of evidence to include but not limited to. I mean, as I said, at some point, I'm asking the court to tell OPD, cut it out. Put some meat on these things. These boilerplate, and I addressed that in here, these boilerplate documents that they use are really a disservice to everyone involved, including the courts. Hit it on the nose.
Oh, I did have one more question, and
I'll stay here all day.
I'm not sure if it'll embarrass me rather than you, but these cases that are coming up, and they're developing on the cusp of Carpenter or on the shoulder, so is there an issue of good faith in any of this? Or it's post-Henderson, so maybe that's diminished?
You know, I remember reading the opinion you wrote on that, and you made mention of the hopes that there would be some parameters set and some protocol set. Tick-tock. What was that? What year was Henderson? A couple of years ago, at least. And until this court tells them enough, they're just going to keep doing it. I don't mean to be a smart guy about it. I'm just saying that's what they're going to do. And they're continuing to do it. And you'll probably see me coming up next year arguing the same stuff.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Ralph, good morning again.
Good morning. May it please the court, again, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. He raises two primary issues, claims the district court erred in denying his motions to suppress one, the CSLI information, and two, the evidence obtained through the warrant search of his house. We disagree regarding the first, the CSLI information. I think we acknowledge that the order under the Federal Stored Communications Act was improper under the relevant case law, but under the circumstances, the exclusionary rule does not apply. Thus, the district court properly denied that motion to suppress.
And then is that because of the good faith exception or because there was a second? There was a warrant?
No, it'd be sort of an iteration of the good faith exception under Kroll, and this court recognized that in Brown in 2019. Basically, at the time that they moved for this order, Jenkins was still good law. Jenkins had approved of the Federal Stored Communications Act order to obtain this type of information. Then subsequent to their getting this information, Carpenter goes up, they get the search warrant. Carpenter says, actually, this is a violation. You need a search warrant, you need a probable cause, and the Federal Stored Communication Act order does not suffice. But then this court in Brown applied the Kroll version of the good faith exception, which says, hey, if the police officers acted in good faith reliance on a statute that had not yet been declared constitutional, then the deterrence rationale, the exclusionary rule, doesn't apply. And we think the same rationale applies here, and actually with more force than in Brown, because Brown occurred before Jenkins, whereas ours occurred after Jenkins had approved basically the conduct, but before Carpenter overruled Jenkins. So that same rationale, I think, applies here, which makes the motion to suppress properly denied in our view. As far as the search warrant search of the house, I rely on this court's decision in State v. Tyler for sort of the severability doctrine, as well as the actual record facts here as to what was obtained and how. The actual evidence of value, in our opinion, which is the clothing, the mask, the surgical gloves, gardening gloves, I think was another one, those were all obtained pursuant to other provisions that were sufficiently particular in the warrant. Those were laid out. They're not in the venue provision or the items of evidentiary value followed by the list of electronic devices provision that he challenges. And so under Tyler, this court has said that those proper provisions may be severed from the challenged ones, and any evidence obtained under those provisions is not excludable. I think the same thing applies here.
What about the particularity for the photos of the two shirts or the items of clothing that were photographed and admitted in the trial, but not necessarily set forth in the warrant or the affidavit?
Well, that provision, I think, allowed the search for those clothes. And then once they are there searching for those clothes, they can photograph them. And so I think that still comes in under that provision, which was sufficiently particular, as opposed to under the venue or the electronic device provision. And so I still think
The reading of the affidavit appeared to show the clothes that were identified at the time of the incident, and the photographs, and that apparently those were something similar to those was recovered. Mm-hmm. However, the photographs appeared more to be clothing that matched the video from the Raising Cane's drive-through. And were those set forth in the were those items of clothing set forth in the warrant?
Well, those specific items of clothing, I don't think they were. I kicked myself a little bit for not making a copy of the search warrant to prep for this, but I don't think that they were specifically set forth. But the stuff that was set forth, I think, was sufficiently particular. And when you're searching for clothing items such as the blue hoodie or I forget the other one, like a jacket, I don't think that there's anything wrong with also noticing when you're doing that search, oh, hey, these clothing items match the surveillance video from the Raising Cane's and photographing those. I still don't think that they came
what,
in
what
under...
What would be the legal rationale?
Some sort of plain view exception. But the fact is that his challenge is just to particularity, and there's nothing wrong with the provision that they actually come in under, which is the clothing provision in our view. So I don't think that there's any issue there.
Were those items actually seized, or were they just photographed at the location?
I think they were just photographed at the location. The return on the search warrant, I don't think, included those. Like I said, I wish I had photocopied the search warrant exhibit, so I don't recall precisely. But for some reason, they did not seize them, and they just had the photographs
at
trial.
What was the... At trial, how did they come in? For what did they establish?
Well, I think as Justice Frydenberg indicated, I think they were to establish that he has this type of clothing and it appears in the Raising Cane's video, making it more likely that, you know, he was that guy.
To help identify
sure.
the driver at the drive-thru.
Yes. So
not that those were the clothing at the time of the crime.
Right, I don't think so. I think it was just to establish the Raising Cane's video, who was the driver, who was there, which, you know, squared up with the cell phone records.
We're back to location.
Right. And
could
all
you
that,
comment
so.
On Mr. Riley's comment that post Henderson the list went from any and all to a list of lots of devices that may or may not be relevant to the case at hand?
Well, I can't comment on like Douglas County practice. I don't know, but I think for purposes of this case, we can just say it's severed because the actual evidence of value was found under the other provisions that were not challenged. I guess that would be my position
in,
there.
In terms of entitlement to here's a list of things that might be relevant to the crime at hand,
Sure,
it could be a computer, it could be your microwave, it just could be anything.
I mean, it'd have to be a case-by-case analysis, I guess, on whether that's sufficiently particular or
is
what they're searching for.
Is it superfluous?
I'm not sure I understand
if
the question.
If they're trying to identify the court, here's what we seek, mm-hmm. and it's fanciful, is that relevant? What's the legal significance of it?
I don't know that I'd go so far as to say fanciful or superfluous. A lot of the times, you know, if they're looking for a particular electronic information, they don't know if it's on a computer versus a phone versus an external hard drive versus a flash drive. So including a comprehensive list would make some sense. I guess beyond that, I guess I would still think it'd have to be a case-by-case analysis. As far as the probable cause argument with the search, warrant search of the house, he really just challenged the inclusion of the DNA in the CSLI. As I said in my brief, I don't really see an issue with that. DNA was sufficiently particular to me, although not maybe precise enough scientifically, and the CSLI, although improperly obtained, was not excludable, so I don't see an issue there either. Unless this court has further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, I don't.
There is no time for rebuttal. This is the last case of the day, so the court is adjourned and you are excused.
Thank you.